Five Live Investigates.
Good morning, my name's Adrian Goldberg and welcome to Five Live Investigates. Today, men who use animal cruelty as a weapon of domestic violence and the women unable to leave dangerous or controlling partners because their family pet could be hurt or even killed. We can reveal that in the last year alone, there have been 700 calls to domestic violence helplines in England and Wales, which included reports of animal cruelty. The charities which run them say that in reality, the true figure will be thousands more. All this at a time when referrals, prosecutions and convictions for domestic violence are at an all-time high. We'll hear some pretty harrowing stories this morning, but this is a story that really matters. And if you want to join in, we'd love to hear from you. You can text us on 85058. You can email goldberg at bbc.co.uk, on Twitter at BBC5Live, or on Facebook, the BBC Radio 5 Live page. First, let's get a distressing story about Laura Ing. She's a single mum from Sunderland with a 9-year-old daughter called Ellie and a pet chihuahua called Molly, who weighed just £3. Laura has been telling our reporter, Philippa Goymer, about what happened when her new boyfriend, Adam McCarthy, came into their lives. And I should warn you that some listeners might find parts of Laura's story upsetting.
He really was, like, perfect. My family loved him. Ellie did. He took Ellie on as his own. He couldn't do, like, enough for us. He was really, really nice. His friend had been down having a drink and Ad went to bed and it was morning and Adam was still drinking. And I woke up and I was like, right, it's time to go. Like, Ellie was with her dad. She comes home about 4 o'clock and this was like 10. And I was like, we need to tidy up. You need to sober up. He was saying I was showing him up in front of his friends and he threw the table off the bedroom mirror because we went in there to talk so his friends didn't hear. And then he grabbed us by the throat and his friend just like ran out the door. I think his friend was so frightened. He just like ran straight out my front door.
And after that first time, I mean, how regular did it become?
Every weekend was a push or like a shove or pinned us up against walls, shouting at us. And every weekend I would see her.
Did your family not notice?
He broke me cheekbone after about 18 months and that's the first thing that they knew and they were furious. But Adam went round to my parents, he apologised, said he would stop drinking and they bought it because he genuinely seemed sorry.
Was there any point that Adam used threatening the dogs or animal cruelty to have more control over you?
Last Christmas, I'd found out he'd been cheating on us and I'd while I was at work, so I wouldn't answer the phone to him. When I did answer, he had said that he had Molly pinned in the corner. And if I didn't speak to him, she wouldn't be here when I got back. I had to tell my manager what was going on and he let us leave work. And I went straight home and he was just like, as if I would do that to the dog. Like, you know, I wouldn't. Like, why would you even think that?
But the point is that he threatened to do it to get you to leave work.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Was there nothing in your mind telling you, I need to get out, not just for the animals, but for my child?
Yeah, because Ellie's dad, he doesn't drink, he doesn't smoke. I went from one extreme to the other, but I was always false promised he would change. Sometimes it was easier to stay with him because it was less hassle.
We do know that this story has a very sad conclusion as far as Molly's concerned. Mm-hmm. Could you tell me about that night?
Yeah, I used to stay over Adam's on a weekend because I could only see him on a weekend because he wasn't allowed around my daughter because of violence and drinking. So I went over, I took my two dogs over, we took them for a walk and it was so nice because it was like it was really hot. We took them to Castletown Dane, they were all off the lead, just running around, they were jumping in the lake. We went to McDonald's for food and Adam was like, oh, shall I have a drink? And I was like, just a little one, because I started my new job on the Monday. Adam came back with just ridiculous amounts. He had 8 cans, he had 4 bottles of Copperberg, and we were just drinking the music, like we had music on, we were just like chilling with the 4 dogs. And then he started kicking off, like shouting at us, saying, I'm never on his side, I'm always on someone else's. So I was like, right, I'm going. As we were walking out of his flat door, he was like nutting the doors, like shouting in my face. We walked down the stairs and he pinned us up by the throat. I couldn't tell you what he was saying because I'd just switched off by this point. I just wanted to get out with Molly. I ducked and tried to get between his arm and his leg and he slammed the door on my face. I was on the floor and I'd screamed because he picked us up and flung us back down. And because I'd screamed, the dog whimpered, Molly, and he just turned around and was like, you can shut up as well, you little rat. And he just booted her off the wall and she just dropped to the floor. And I knew straight away she was dead because she was just totally still. Like, she wasn't crying, whimpering, nothing. She was just gone.
Such a sad story. And last week, Laura's ex, 28-year-old Adam McCarthy, was jailed for 6 months for causing unnecessary suffering to an animal after killing the family pet. He also received 5 months for attacking Laura. The day before, he got a 14-month sentence for seriously wounding a previous girlfriend. It would be good to say that Laura's story was a one-off or even a rarity. Sadly, it isn't. Gemma Willis joins us now in the studio with her dog, a Rottweiler German Shepherd Cross called Dusty. Morning to you, Gemma.
Morning, my love.
I should say, a few months ago, your ex-partner, Richard Ridley, was given a jail sentence of 13 and a half years after pleading guilty to offences, including assault, sexual assault, a fray. You've waived your right to anonymity. You must recognise a lot of what Laura has just been speaking about.
I do. It's just pretty heartbreaking and really sad to hear that, you know, I mean, Dusty was beaten, but to lose him, oh God, that would have broke me. My heart goes out to it, really does.
How badly was your dog Dusty beaten and attacked over the years?
He'd been hit with a shovel. He'd been punched, kicked, pinned in the corner of the shed to be beaten. Used to throw hammers at them. Because I had two at the time. It was just awful.
And sometimes he would intervene to try and protect you because you were being very seriously beaten as well.
He did once, actually. Dusty's never bitten. I mean, his temperament's absolutely beautiful, but he did bite once. Dusty was never in the house. He always watched through the back window in the front room and in the dining room. All I could ever see was his big brown eyes, just watching what was going on and barking and trying to get through the window. On this one occasion, Dusty was in the utility room behind the baby gate and he actually cleared the baby. I think I was knocked out because I come round and Dusty was in front of me and Richard was screaming and there was just blood all over and the dog was growling and barking and Richard was just shouting, get him out of the house, get him out of the house. So I put the dog out the back, but Richard literally calmed down, you know, and, oh, horrendous. But that's the only one time he's ever bitten.
And how much of the abuse that you suffered was because you wanted to keep the home and to protect Dusty?
To be honest, towards the last year of being with Richard, it was survival mode, not protective mode. I knew he wasn't going to hurt Logan, my son. I knew the dogs were getting it, but if I kept them at a safe distance, and towards the last year, he spent less time attacking the dogs and more focusing on me. So it made it quite difficult, really.
So in a sense, you were staying there to put yourself between Richard, your abuser, and the dog.
Well, I didn't know. I knew what was going on was wrong, but I'd asked for help. I'd reached out to help for help, and nobody had helped me. I had nowhere to go, no one to turn to. I didn't know about refuge. I didn't know about the Dogs Trust Freedom Project. And because I'd already reached out for help and got none, I thought, well, this is it. This is my life. Till he got me to the point where it was, well, I don't want this life, and if he doesn't kill me, I'm gonna end my own life, because it's the only way I can see Logan and the animals getting free, and the only way they'd get gone is if I was gone, because Richard was never going to let me go, never.
I mentioned that you've waived your right to anonymity. Why have you decided to speak out?
Because I've gone through so much and I've felt so lonely, and all I've ever had is negativity. I mean, even when it come out what had been going on, there was a remark passed, I won't say who by, but they went, what sort of mother puts their son in that position like you did yours? And I just thought, I didn't. And I asked for help and nobody, I couldn't get out of this. No one had helped me. It wasn't my fault. No one would help. So I'm not a bad mum. So then it put me on an even more downward spiral. It made me really poorly because I have mental health conditions as it is. And it really affected me, and I just, the more I was going down, the worse I was feeling, and I thought, no, I've got to find a positive. I'd spent that long being told off Richard I was no good and nobody would want me, and then he was never going to let me go, and I needed a positive. Spending my life being negative has just destroyed me. Nobody's prepared to help or push me back up, so I'm doing it myself, and if I can help at least one woman or however many pets, I've done well. I've achieved something. It was worth going through for something. And I'm not a bad person or a bad mum.
We'll hear more from you in a little while, Gemma, about how you got out of that nightmarish situation. I really appreciate you coming on and sharing your story with us this morning. I know it's not easy for you. I should say as well that if you or someone you know have been affected by domestic abuse or violence, you can find a list of organisations that can help at our website, bbc.co.uk/actionline. And if you are in immediate danger, you should call 999. Now, our reporter, Laura Harms, has been looking at this. And Laura, this isn't something that you normally hear being talked about, the link between domestic abuse and animal cruelty. When did you first get an inkling this kind of thing was going on?
Well, you'll remember, Adrian, that back in April we did a story about coercive and controlling behaviour in relationships. And as part of my research for that, I spoke to a woman who told me about a pattern of controlling behaviour by her ex-partner, which also involved using violence or threats against her cat as a psychological weapon against her. She told me about how he used to kick, threaten and shout at the cat. She told me that he once put it in a suitcase and swung it around the room. And she told me that the cat was so scared of him by the end that it used to defecate on the floor every time that he entered the room. So I started looking into this, the links between people who harm their partners and also harm their pets, and realising there were loads of similar stories. And in the worst cases, animals had actually been killed.
So what is the scale of the problem?
Well, the truth is that no one really knows for sure, but what we've got is probably the most accurate snapshot that anyone's come up with so far. This is based on calls to the National Domestic Violence Helpline. That's run by the charities Women's Aid and Refuge in England. And when they're trying to assess the level of danger that a caller is in, they'll go through a risk assessment that often includes a question about whether the perpetrator has ever harmed the family pet or another animal. In England last year, around 1 in 10 people who this question applied to answered yes to that question. In Wales, they've got a similar separate helpline run by Welsh Women's Aid. And last year, around 1 in 5 people said yes to that animal abuse question. And the charities have told us they're convinced the true figures are much higher than that. They say victims are often worried that if they reveal their pet has been harmed too, it will be taken away from them.
But overall, on those figures, then, we've got 700 men in England and Wales who are domestic abusers who have also harmed an animal. Laura, for now, thank you. We're keen to hear your story. Stories and comments as well, do drop us a text to 85058 or at Beep Animal Cruelty. Let's get a word now with Rachel Horman, a solicitor who specialises in domestic violence cases. Good morning to you, Rachel.
Good morning.
So how often does this kind of link come up in cases that you deal with?
It comes up very often, actually. I would say probably in about a third of cases of domestic abuse.
What kinds of things then?
Lots of things. I've dealt with probably hundreds of cases, kittens thrown against the wall and obviously are killed, kittens and puppies that are stamped on in front of children, pets that are drowned, thrown out of windows, dogs that are kicked, stabbed, punched, threats to skin the cat alive in front of the children, horses stabbed with pitchforks. It just goes on and on, but it's extremely terrifying. As well as being upsetting about what's actually happening to the pet, it's really terrifying for the woman and often the children that are aware of this going on.
And we've talked about this figure of 700 men who are abusers who've also got a history of hurting animals. The fact that 1 in 3 of the cases that you deal with has this link, it would suggest that the true figure of this is much, much greater.
Definitely, it's much higher. And it's specifically because I ask that question. And I think a lot of people don't ask about abuse of animals or threats of abuse to animals. So it goes, it's a hidden aspect of domestic abuse, but it's an extremely common one in my view.
How often are people prosecuted then for harming animals as well as their partners?
Very rarely. And very rarely is the animal abuse used as an example of coercive control, because obviously coercive control is now a criminal offence. And to me, these threats of abuse against the animals or actual abuse against the animals could be used as an example of coercive control and used within prosecutions.
And again, we'll come to this in a bit more detail a little later, Rachel. If people don't understand what we're talking about here, coercive control is a threat to injure a pet or animal in order to make a victim compliant. No harm may actually ensue to the animal because presumably in many cases the victim will just give in order to protect the animal.
Yeah, it's a way of controlling the woman, making them stay in the relationship or do what they want. So we heard earlier that if you don't come home, I'm going to hurt the dog. And actually, pets are often a reason why women can't leave. I've dealt with a woman who had a flock of sheep. She couldn't really go into a refuge and get a flock of sheep rehomed. It's very difficult. And she knew if she left, he would kill the sheep. And I often deal with farmers and people who have pets that aren't perhaps easy to rehome, who are very isolated and stuck where they are. So it's a real problem that we need to address.
Rachel, thanks very much indeed for your time this morning. Lawyer Rachel Horman. Our reporter Laura Harms is with us still. And Laura, you mentioned earlier that when calls are made to the National Domestic Violence Helpline, victims are sometimes asked if the perpetrator has a history of animal abuse as well, but not always.
No, not always in the past, but that is going to change. Following our investigation, the manager of the National Domestic Violence Helpline has told me they've now decided they're going to make that question mandatory as part of a risk assessment, which will help them to better identify the risk to a victim and also give a more accurate sense of the scale of this problem.
Okay, so a little bit of a result there. That's good to hear. Let's hear now from a domestic abuse survivor we'll call Jenny. She endured more than a decade of physical violence and psychological abuse at the hands of her now ex-partner, who is also the father of her children. She says one of the reasons she stayed in the relationship was that she felt a responsibility to the family pets, dogs, chickens and so on, and for many years felt she couldn't leave them. Again, you might find the details upsetting.
They brought the sunshine in my life because there wasn't really very much at home. And it was a way of me getting out with the children, you know. If we had dogs, we could go out in the car and go to the beach. And it was at the time of abusing the animals that I knew that it was my time to go. I didn't go to save me. I went to save them. He'd have killed them. He'd have hurt them so badly. And I just couldn't do that. It wasn't right, yeah.
What makes you think that he would have hurt the animals?
He already did. Just before I fled, he started with the chickens. I found a couple with their necks wrung. Then he would cut the heads off and leave them on the doorstep. And I knew that that was... Well, I had 10 chickens and I ended up with just 2. It was a horrible way for them to go and massively unfair. And that was my fault because I didn't leave in time to stop that.
How difficult was it for you to make that decision to go?
Honestly, the hardest decision of my life. We packed bags and fled in the middle of the night in my car with all those animals. I was terrified. I could not go back to that because I probably wouldn't have come away from it again. So I had to do it.
To what extent was fear for the animals, as well as for your kids?
As much as for my children, because they are part of my family. They really are. They are 100% my responsibility. It was a case of over my dead body, which sounds a little extreme, but I meant it.
People listening to this might say you've done incredibly well to get out of a really difficult personal situation under that psychological and physical pressure.
Yeah.
And that to get out of it for the sake of your children and for yourself would be enough.
There are people who don't understand the human-animal bond. I've already met with several women who've been in my situation. I've met with several relatives of women who have lost their lives to save their pets.
That's incredible, isn't it? A really chilling line there from Jenny saying that she's met the relatives of women who lost their lives to save their pets. That's just how serious this can get. I should say that Jenny is now living with her children and her animals a long way from the man who made their lives such a misery. They managed to escape and start a new life. But for many, that's not always an option. That's because many women's refuges don't allow animals. And that obviously can add to the difficulties of getting away from an abuser. And we heard earlier from Gemma Willis, who is still with us.
Gemma, you did eventually manage to get away, but that was part of the problem that you faced. There was nowhere that could take you with your dog, Dusty.
No, there was, to me, it was, I had no, literally nowhere to go, and it, nothing was in like a section of, oh, well, what am I going to do with the dog, and where are me and Logan going to go, and it was just all in one. That was my family, my two boys and me.
And it was really interesting when we heard from Jenny there saying that, you know, my pets are part of my family as much as my kids. You were nodding away at that part of the interview. Yeah.
It was nice to hear, because I feel a bit of a fruitcake sometimes when I talk about Dusty. But when she was right, when you've got nothing else and nobody else, the most important thing sometimes you hold dear are what's left with you in that house, and that was Logan and the dog.
There was a project though to help you, set up by the Dogs Trust, the Freedom Project. Just explain how that worked.
I'd gone into refuge and they'd asked me if I had any pets, and I said yeah. They said they weren't allowed in, gave me a number and said they might not be able to help me, but they might be able to direct me. So I gave the number a call and dealt with a lady called Sarah the whole way through. I think it was about 24 hours and she had him up, ready to be fostered out and everything. It was really good. So helpful.
As we're speaking, by the way, Dusty's getting friendly with Don Busby, our sports reader, showing what a friendly dog she is. Just have a listen to this, Gemma, because your dog was fostered by a chap called Frank. He looked after Dusty for you and he remembers Dusty with great fondness.
Oh, Dusty. Everybody liked Dusty. It was when they said a Rottweiler, German Shepherd cross, I thought, But temperament, beautiful temperament. Everybody liked him. They met him. They still talk about him, some people, yeah. It's a two-way thing. You get the company of the dog. You get the exercise, and it gives you something to do. The fact that you're actually helping somebody as well, although you never get to see them, which is fair enough, that's a bonus. But you tell the difference when the dog's gone back, and there's a cat without a dog, and you're coming into an empty house. That takes getting used to again. But you know, there'll be another one. There always is.
Oh, Gemma, listening to that with Frank, you're getting very emotional, understandably. It means so much to you.
It does. Because the fostering service allowed me to keep what the last of what I left. I've lost everything. You know, I was sleeping on a blanket. I had no sofa because he'd stabbed it all. It was just me, Logan and Dusty left. And that man changed my life. He really did. And I'm so grateful to him. And if I could cuddle you, Frank, and you're listening, I would.
Oh, Gemma, thank you so much. And there is a beautiful film, by the way, on BBC Stories made by our colleague Ruth Evans. And you can see a video which features both Gemma and Frank on the BBC News website. It is absolutely lovely. Yeah, thank you so much, Gemma, honestly. Yeah. And you know, it's touched all of our hearts to see you in the studio this morning with Dusty as well.
Thank you.
And I say it's getting very friendly with Don Busby over there. Coming up, we'll hear about the vets who find themselves on the front line of identifying domestic violence. It's 11:30. Cruelty and domestic violence, even murder. We've discovered that hundreds of victims of violence in the home say the person who hurt them also has hurt a family pet or another animal. Getting your reaction to what you've been hearing this morning. Louise says, this is heartbreaking. I can't understand why so many refuges don't accept pets. I wish the system was different. Pets are part of the family and deserve to be protected, as well as the other family members, from these horrible partners. Keep your comments coming. You can text us on 85058 or at BBC 5 Live. Now, Carol Marsden is from the domestic violence charity Endeavour. Endeavour was the first in the country to set up a pet fostering scheme for victims of domestic violence. It's called Paws for Kids. So far, they've helped more than 1,100 women and fostered more than 1,800 pets. Carol, good morning to you.
Good morning, Adrian.
And as we've heard very graphically this morning, such a need for this kind of service. But you started this, I think, 18 years ago. So what incident prompted you to start offering this kind of service?
Well, actually, Adrian, at that time, I worked in a women's refuge, and for a number of years, it had been a problem when women turned up at the door or wanted to be referred, and they had animals as part of the family. So we would try our best to get people to look after them, but it wasn't always possible. And on one such occasion, when I was working in the refuge, an older woman came to the door, and she had a Labrador cross dog with her, and she'd spent the night sleeping in the stairwell of a block of masonettes with her and a dog. and we let her into the refuge, and we could find space for her, but we tried our best and couldn't find anything at all for a dog. You know, she just looked at me and she said, well, I'll be going home then.
Oh my gosh, and for someone who works, as you do, at the sharp end of domestic violence and abuse, to hear somebody who's been abused for many years finally had the courage and been able to kind of get away from that situation to tell you that they're going back into it because there's nowhere else for the dog to go. That must have been heartbreaking for you.
Absolutely, because this particular woman had stayed at home, you know, with the abuse as her family was growing up.
Mm.
And now, you know, she was in her 60s, a family had all left home, but she'd got a dog, you know, that was just as much as part of her family as her children. So, you know, we knew there was something that needed doing because, you know, when there is violence in a home, you know, a perpetrator of violence, a violent man, will use whatever is in that home to control that person. And if there are animals there, it only stands to reason, you know, that he'll use the animals in the same manner as we've heard earlier on in the programme, you know.
And as you mentioned, men, one or two listeners saying, well, of course, men can be victims of domestic violence too. But in the cases that you have dealt with, what's the ratio female to male here?
Yeah, I mean, we don't just operate a pet fostering service. We have five different services for people experiencing escaping domestic abuse. The majority of our clients are women, but there are men who come through the service.
In terms of the pet fostering, though, am I right in thinking that there's only been one man in those 18 years?
There has been one man. Now, sometimes that doesn't mean that men aren't experiencing violence. It means sometimes that there's other means open to them for getting support, because they could be working. They've got money. They could put their animals perhaps in kennels. Where very often women in that situation have no control over the finances.
So how does, very briefly, if you wouldn't mind, how does the system work?
Yeah, how it actually works is we take referrals from the woman themselves or the man or the police or anybody who's working with that family. And then what we try and do as much as possible is match up the placement with one of our pet foster carers. We've 43 pet foster carers at the moment who look after animals in their own home, you know, for varying lengths of time. So if it's an animal, say, from an elderly person like we spoke about, we'll try and match that up with one of our older pet foster carers. If it's an animal from a family where there's children, you know, vice versa, we will match that up with a family who the animal is then used to children. So, you know, the main thing for us is we can't place dogs in the same area as we pick them up, because from our experience, a perpetrator will go to any lengths to try and find his partner or his wife or his children. So we have to have a big register of foster care. Unfortunately, the pet fostering service is completely unfunded. You know, all our fundraising goes towards keeping this much-needed service going, you know.
Carol, really appreciate your time this morning, and well done on you for the good work that you do. Thank you for joining us this morning. That's Carol Marsden from Endeavour talking about their pet fostering scheme for victims of domestic violence called Paws for Kids. And really interesting to hear about the way in which that's dealt with there, but clearly isn't offered by refugees around the country. Now, a little earlier, I spoke to George Howard. He's the tactical lead on domestic abuse for North Wales Police, and his team of officers frequently see family pets being harmed and even killed. He started by telling me about the scale of the problem of domestic violence that he and his officers face on a daily basis, and be warned, some of the details here will be upsetting.
For North Wales Police, we deal with about 30 domestic abuse reports a day. Just before I came on air, I scanned the last 10 domestic abuse cases which we have assessed as high risk. And out of that 10, 6 of them had answered yes to the question about animal cruelty and if the perpetrator had mistreated an animal in the history of their relationship. I would say that's fairly typical of what we see, especially in higher risk cases, where you do see that link between the domestic abuse and animal cruelty.
When you say high risk, what do you mean?
High risk means at risk of significant harm or murder as a result of the perpetrator's actions.
What kind of cases have you and your colleagues seen?
We see a variety of cases. There are some that are quite common, which people may kind of identify with, people talking about kicking the dog in a kind of rather light-hearted way, but actually quite often we do see animals abused in this way. Recently we've had a perpetrator who picked up a puppy and kicked it across the room, which killed the puppy. There's a more extreme case where a perpetrator threw a pitchfork into a horse's neck. Other things which seem to be quite common are things like using bleach into goldfish bowls, throwing cats against the wall. So it's a variety of things. Sometimes these things happen as part of an incident which also involves physical harm to the victim or the family, but often it can be unrelated to that, but it is obviously used as part of a pattern of coercive control that the perpetrator is using.
Could you think of an example to illustrate how abuse of a pet might be used in a coercive and controlling relationship?
I've heard of cases where animals are used to wield power over the victim. For example, I've heard an account where a perpetrator took the children's cat for a few days and hid it elsewhere, didn't tell the children. Once it had been established by the children and the victim that had been missing, he then tells the victim that he has the cat, but he hasn't decided if it's coming back yet. And something like that could be to gain some kind of compliance in relation to the relationship. It might be to coerce somebody to prevent them from leaving an abusive relationship, or it might be to ensure that child access is favourable, or it could be simply out of either revenge or to instill fear. These pets are family pets, they're the children's pets. So there's the psychological pressure on the victim to manage the children's concerns and worries for their pet, all the while not knowing if that animal is going to survive. What happened in this particular case I was told of is that a few days later the perpetrator returns the cat to the family. He's kind of seen as the all-conquering hero. Dad's come back and he found the cat who was just a couple of streets away, was the story that's given. But by that point, it's very clear to the victim that that can happen at any time and the outcome could be different the next time. It's hugely impactful on a victim's psychology and emotional well-being.
That was George Howard. He's the Strategic Domestic Abuse Officer at North Wales Police. Now, given the links between animal cruelty and crimes like domestic violence, what can be done to protect victims, both human and animals? Well, I caught up with Paula Boyden and Frieda Scott Park from an organisation called The Lynx Group at the London Vet Show on Friday. They provide training to vets to spot the signs of animal abuse.
In terms of the signs of non-accidental injury, it will come as no great surprise that the signs that we see in animals are just the same as the signs that we have in humans, because you've got one big common denominator, and that's the human perpetrator. So we'll see that the history is inconsistent with the injury, so generally the injury is far too severe for the history that's been given.
What kind of examples do you tell the vets then who are training that you talk to?
Some of the classic ones are, for example, cigarette burns. In terms of a cigarette burn, they're quite definitive in their nature, and we will see them in both animals and with humans. So those sorts of injuries are classical. The sorts of signs that we see from a fractured skull are exactly the same whether we're dealing with a human or an animal.
And I think there was an example of owners shopping around for vets. Just explain that.
So what they'll basically do is go to a different vet every time. So they're basically hiding their tracks, because one of the other key indicators are repetitive injuries. And certainly a number of the cases that we discuss at the undergraduate training is where animals have been presented multiple times over a very short period of time. And the way to hide your tracks is to see a different vet every time.
From your point of view, Frieda, is there a sense that because people come to you with concern for their animal, that you are over-willing, perhaps, to believe their account of what's happened?
That's certainly what I was like as a new graduate, and they can be really difficult to spot unless you're able to step back and discuss something that just doesn't feel quite right in the circumstance. And it's through the Lynx Veterinary Training Initiative that we're trying to show vets how, just if they get a gut feeling about the story
or perhaps look back at the previous history, how they can actually begin to understand that something more might be going on in this household. When they begin to ask the right questions, like, sometimes when I see injuries like this to an animal, it means they've been hurt by somebody that they love. Could this have happened to your pet? When they ask that very gentle question about the circumstances, what we're finding is that increasing number of vets are getting disclosures about what's happening in the household. It might be something like, well, yes, my partner kicked the dog because he was trying to make me do something. Or maybe even, yes, he kicked the dog after he'd really hurt the child and the child's screaming was irritating him, so he lashed out at the dog. And that, of course, puts the veterinary surgeon in a very difficult situation unless they're trained to cope with it.
And it's clear from what I've heard today, Frieda, that there is still work to be done to alert vets to the possibility of non-accidental injury and the likelihood, in some cases, that there is a link between that non-accidental injury to the animal and domestic abuse.
Our experience over the last 20 years has shown us that vets fall into different categories. There are those, like myself, who are a bit older, who never received any training and really didn't understand that these sort of non-accidental injuries can occur. And those are the vets that we say don't see, don't hear. We have an unfortunate group of individuals in the veterinary profession who are perhaps some of the more senior partners who don't see, don't hear, and don't want to get involved. And it's really that intractability that we're trying to break down to say, look, the new young veterinary surgeons are actually getting well trained in the universities to recognise what the signs of abuse are and recognise this concept off the violent household where animals and humans are at risk. And therefore the young vets are coming out with a much more open view and able to recognise abuse when it's looking at them, but they're not getting support from their senior colleagues, and that's what we're trying to change.
That's Frieda Scott-Park and Paula Boyden from the Lynx Group at the London Vet Show. Now, Dr. Emma Allen is a senior lecturer in forensic psychology at the University of Kent, been researching the psychology of people who abuse animals. Emma, good morning to you.
Good morning.
So let's a little bit about your research then, how it's carried out and what you found.
So I'm interested in the perpetrators of animal abuse quite broadly, regardless of context, but domestic abuse is one of the contexts that I do look at. And so I research the social and psychological characteristics of animal abusers, trying to understand why someone would choose to harm an animal as opposed to engage in any other types of antisocial behavior or harm another person. And because animal abuse is so underreported, and that you don't find a lot of animal abusers in prison to interview, I tend to conduct my research in the community. And through anonymous surveys, I get information from people who talk about perpetrating animal abuse and tell me a little bit about themselves and about the motivations for why they engage in that behavior.
And, you know, a little earlier on, we had Dusty, the Rottweiler German Shepherd Cross in the studio, had been a victim of abuse. His owner had also been a victim of domestic abuse as well. And you see a big, cuddly dog like that, and you think, how could anyone hurt that animal, or indeed any other animal? So what kind of personality traits have you identified?
Well, what you find in that particular example and many other examples is that people who really struggle to kind of manage or control their emotions or those extreme emotions are looking for an outlet for that. And so in those circumstances, they're looking for a way to kind of release that aggression. And if you know if you harm a person, that person can go report it, you can get caught. Many times they might look to the animal and think, well, if I harm the animal, no one will know, or that's a way to control the person from, coerce the person from not wanting to leave. But they see the animal as a lesser of those evils, and a way of getting away with trying to perpetrate domestic abuse.
And we heard one victim earlier saying that people have died in order to protect their animals, yes, victims of domestic abuse. Is there a link between animal cruelty and murder?
There isn't necessarily a causal link. There definitely is a relationship where you find people who perpetrate animal abuse are very likely to engage in other types of offending behavior, and violence is one of them. And unfortunately, in that particular kind of example, what you find is that perpetrators of domestic abuse know that there is that strong emotional attachment between their victim and the victim's animal. And that's why they target the animal, because they know that they can control that person. Unfortunately, what will end up happening is either the victim, who is the person, or the animal may die as a consequence of that. But it is that kind of emotional attachment that they've learned exists there, which gives them the upper hand, if you want to call it that.
Emma, I really appreciate your time this morning. Thank you. Dr. Emma Allen from the University of Kent. And if you or someone you know have been affected by domestic abuse or violence, you can find a list of organisations to help at bbc.co.uk/actionline. And if you are in immediate danger, you should dial 999. It's 6 minutes to 12.